Thank you, Emily and team, for leading us in worship this morning musically. Have you appreciated their leadership this morning? Just a couple families I would like to ask that you would keep in your prayer lives through this week. At the tail end of last week, Richard Skipper and Loretta Anderson's mom, Alice, passed away. Her wake will be from 4 to 7 tomorrow at Belvedere, and her celebration of life service is on Tuesday at 3 p.m. at the Christian Reformed Church. So we'll be sending this information out, but just wanted you to be praying for Richard and Barb and their family, and Loretta and Derek and their family. Last evening, late afternoon, early evening, Trent McDonald's mom, who is Danny Stretch's grandmother, who is Janet McKenzie's aunt, Aura McDonald, passed away. And so if you would keep all of that family in your prayers, and they were getting the details for services squared away this morning, so as soon as we know all of those details, we will pass them on to you. How many of you are glad that March break is all over? Let me see your hands. A lot of tentative giggles. Justice cannot sleep forever. Justice cannot sleep forever. You do not have to read very far in the Gospels before discovering that the words that Jesus spoke and the way that he spoke them, coupled with the countercultural way that he lived, made him then and still makes him today a threat to the status quo. Not everyone was, not everyone is a fan of God's Son. This carpenter from Nazareth was proving to be a controversial, an incendiary, a revolutionary figure to such a degree that the established religious authorities felt it was their sacred responsibility to take control of things, to get control of this runaway train. Not only was Jesus enabling people to see their lives and living in a new way, with every new convert, the traditional religious hierarchy felt their power slipping away. So something drastic, something severe, something terminal needed to be done to this rabble-rousing rabbi. 2 weeks ago, we started our series, The Final Hours. I would encourage you, if you haven't picked up, it's an 8-week series. This is week 3. If you have not picked up one of your devotional guides, they're out on the table out there, and it makes it nice to just jump in after a week of reading what we're going to be talking about. But last week, we saw how Judas, the treasurer for Jesus' group, turned state's witness. And for 30 pieces of silver, he sold Jesus out to a group of hired guns. In the Garden of Gethsemane, when Jesus was ambushed, his friends ran for their lives, leaving him to sink or swim on his own. After being taken to a kangaroo court, held at the home of Caiaphas the high priest, eventually Jesus finds himself standing before the Roman governor Pilate, who asks Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And depending on which gospel you're reading, Jesus responds in a few different ways. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, he says to Pilate, "It is as you say." In John's gospel, we find him engaged in a more philosophical discussion in which he compares two kingdoms, the kingdom of this world and the kingdom of God. Serving as lead prosecutors, the temple priests and elders testify that Jesus' teaching had been causing riots everywhere that he went. They claimed he was a public nuisance, causing disorderly civil conduct. They accused him of blasphemy, because he had called himself God's son. And perhaps most damning of all, the charge that had the most persuasive impact upon the Roman governor was Jesus' very claim to be king. A not-so-subtle suggestion of treason against the Roman occupying government. To Pilate's amazement, Jesus remains silent against all of the rantings and railings against him. He seems oblivious to what was taking place. as well as the gravity of the situation in which he found himself. In frustration, Pilate tries to elicit some kind of response. Can't you hear what they're saying about you, Jesus? Don't you have anything to say in your defense, Jesus? How do you plead? And the scriptures tell us that Jesus remains silent. Isaiah 53 and 7 says, he was oppressed and he was treated harshly, yet he never said a word. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, as a sheep is silent before its shearers. He didn't open his mouth. Do you ever find it hard to keep your mouth shut when you've been attacked? Just ask. The conspiratorial movers and shakers work the crowd, persuading the mob attending the proceedings to demand that Pilate honor tradition, to extend a pardon for a death row inmate called Barabbas. If I do that, said Pilate, what do you want me to do with this Jesus fellow? His feeble attempts to reason with the mob prove futile as the chant, crucify him, crucify him, crucify him, builds in momentum until it reverberates around the hall. Cowed by the mob, against the best counsel of both his wife and his conscience, Pilate concedes to the screaming crowd, symbolically washing his hands of the blood of an innocent man. Democracy wins the day. Majority rules. The loudest voices swing the vote. And Pilate capitulates, doing the easy thing instead of doing the right thing. Thus we find Matthew 27, 26 saying, Pilate released Barabbas to them. He ordered Jesus flogged with a lead-tipped whip and then turned him over to the Roman soldiers to be crucified. Proving the philosopher Plato's words to be true. Justice in the life and conduct of the state is possible only as it first resides in the hearts and souls of the citizens. I assume, maybe incorrectly, but I assume that in every home there are some universal discussions that frequently take place. Being the proud parent of an 8, soon-to-be 9-year-old, one of the conversations in which my wife and I frequently find ourselves engaged in these days concerns defending ourselves against the charge, that's not fair. And what's amazing about those three little words is how adaptable they are for any number of situations. It's amazing. And so we're going to be a little interactive this morning, and I'm going to say a bunch of statements after which I would like all of you to say back to me, that's not fair. Now you have to whine a little bit. You have to put it in your nose a little bit. That's not fair. Okay? It's time for your shower. Oh, you guys are great. Please do your homework. It's time to go to bed. Screen time for today is over. No more ice cream. Put your clothes away, please, and make your bed. You're losing your intensity, church. Did you feed the dog? No cell phone until you're 25 years of age. But here's what I found about that accusation. First, I'm coming to understand that 9 out of 10 times, those words have a certain integrity or credibility, at least from the perspective of the accuser. When judged on a scale of what others can do, some of the restrictions, some of the limitations, some of the guidelines, some of the expectations don't seem fair. Life lesson 101. Sometimes life is not fair. But I'm also coming to understand that that cry, that's not fair, scratches at a fundamental human itch which God has hardwired into human beings, the intense longing for justice. Somewhere along the line, that's not fair strikes a chord within every single human heart. And I may be wrong this morning, but from my own personal experience, it seems that the older I get, the more injustices I seem to see. Injustice. The violation of one's rights. That's not fair. And so here's this morning's big idea. God never promises that everything in our earthly existence will be fair. But a day is coming when He will make everything right. Until that day, He promises to walk through personal injustice with us and confront the injustice of others through us. I want to say that once more. God never promises that everything in our earthly existence will be fair. But a day is coming when He will make everything right. Until that day, He promises to walk through personal injustice with us and to confront the injustice of others through us. While walking, while making our way from the cradle to the grave, we'll become familiar with two broad categories of injustice. First, unless we are completely self-absorbed, we will recognize injustice against others. Often the most vulnerable to being utilized for someone else's benefit or gain. Women, children, the elderly, the poor, the mentally ill, the physically and mentally challenged, those struggling with addictions, the grieving, single parents, divorcees, prisoners, those whose skin is a different color than our own, those who have a different religious belief than our own, those from another culture. Isaiah 1:17 tells the child of God, "Learn to do good, seek justice, help the oppressed, defend the cause of orphans, fight for the rights of widows." The Christ follower has the responsibility. We are given the mandate to respond to injustices against other people. The ancient historian Thucydides provocatively said that justice will not come until those who are not injured are as indignant as those who are. And so the follower of Christ must ask the question, How can we best confront injustice in the lives of other people? Luke records that one Sabbath, Jesus made His way to the synagogue. Someone passed Him a scroll, and from which He read these words, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, for He has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim that captives will be released, the blind will see, and that the oppressed will be set free. Time of the Lord's favor has come." The gospel narratives track Jesus doing this for the next 3 years, confronting injustice in the lives of those He comes in contact with. As the founding citizen of another kingdom, by living in a countercultural way, Jesus confronted injustice, showing that there was and is a life-giving alternative to the business-as-usual matrix of a secular system. So what are some ways that we as a church family can practically confront injustice in the lives of others? We can support shelters for women and men. We can work in the prom dress ministry. We can support the crisis pregnancy center. We can volunteer our time and food for the soup kitchen. We can bring a ball of yarn to the upper room. We can participate in the benevolent offering, which we take once a month, which help out people in seasons of financial difficulty. We can help cook some meals to come alongside people in seasons where cooking should be the last thing that they have to be concerned about. We can babysit for the moms group. We can participate in nursing home services. We can serve in the children's ministry. The righteous ones that Jesus describes in Matthew 25, on the day of judgment, ask the king and the judge, when did we ever see you hungry and feed you? Thirsty and give you a drink? When did we ever see you sick or in prison and come to you? And then the king and then the judge will respond, whenever you did that, any one of those things, to someone who is overlooked or ignored. Listen, you did it to me. You did it to me. And so the first question to answer this morning is, are we confronting injustice in the lives of others? The other broad category of injustice is when we are the victims. Most of us have learned sooner rather than later that of all of the blessings and perks that do come with being a citizen of God's kingdom, a get-out-of-injustice-free card is not one of them. Just because you follow Jesus does not mean you won't get shafted. There are times in which you will get a raw deal. There are seasons where you will end up getting the short end of the stick. Forget about getting a piece of pie. You might not get any of the pie. Not necessarily all the time. Definitely not for all time. But certainly enough times that, not unlike my 8-year-old, you'll be tempted to throw your hands up in despair and say, it's not fair. And I'm not just referring to being a victim of circumstance, feeling the inevitable difficulties that stem from being broken and living in a broken world. I'm talking about intentionally being targeted to be messed over or taken advantage of, used and abused. Do not be surprised when this happens. In chapters 15 and 16 of John's Gospel, Jesus is trying to prepare his friends for his death. And he draws a stark contrast between the kingdom of this world and the kingdom of God when he says to them and to us, I chose you to come out of the world, and so it hates you. Since they persecuted me, says Jesus, they will naturally persecute you. I am telling you these things now, said Jesus, so that when they happen, not if, but when they happen, you will remember my warning. Here on earth, you will have many trials and sorrows. These were painful lessons that Jesus had gleaned from his own experience. From the moment that he started his ministry, he had been badgered and criticized and ridiculed and slandered and despised and undercut. He had been the firsthand victim of injustice more times than he can count. From those closest to him, in Mark chapter 3, we find Jesus' family going to him and saying, cut out this Messiah stuff. You're crazy. And if your family think that you're a nut job because you're following a different king? His disciples never seemed to get it. And then there were the attacks from those who were more distant, like all of the religious leaders who wanted Jesus' head on a plate. Some of us in this place this morning can relate extremely well to scriptures like Psalm 44, where we read, all we hear are the taunts of our mockers. All we see are our vengeful enemies. Wake up, Lord. Why do you sleep? Get up. Why do you look the other way? Psalm 25, Lord, see how many enemies I have and how viciously they hate me. Protect me. Rescue my life from them. And how many of us in our spiritual lives at one point or another have not felt like David when he wrote in Psalm 13, how long, O Lord? How long will you forget me? How long will my enemy have the upper hand? Turn and answer me, O God. Restore the sparkle to my eyes, or I will die. Don't let my enemies gloat, saying, ha, we've defeated them. Don't let them rejoice when I fall down. Every one of these psalms of lament encourage a godly approach to handling personal injustice. An approach that Jesus utilized when he was on trial before Pilate. Would you please take note of what Jesus did not do? He didn't deny the injustice. He did not bury his head in a sand like a see no evil, hear no evil ostrich. He did not play metaphysical mind games like the Stoic philosophers who claim that overcoming evil is a simple issue of mind over matter. He didn't bellyache, and he didn't complain, and he didn't whine, and he didn't moan like Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. Woe is me. That's not a bad Eeyore, eh? He didn't concede that he was responsible for the injustice that he carried. He didn't try to escape the injustice. He didn't plead guilty to a lesser sentence. He did not hire a big gun defense attorney or team to get him off. He did not take justice into his own hands, vigilante style, like Clint Eastwood or The Punisher. And you know what else he didn't do? He didn't mount a counterattack using Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube. If I can just say, and if you can please hear this from the spirit that it's intended, the next time you're a victim of injustice, would you please prayerfully consider staying away from online social media platforms? The temptation to verbally strike back may be too juicy to resist, and you may never know the harm that is done to your witness once you hit them. Just saying. Romans 12 is startling in its clarity. Never take revenge. Leave that to the righteous anger of God. In stark contrast to a dominant worldview that tells us to fight tooth and claw for our rights, Psalm 37 tells us, do not worry about the wicked, or envy those who do wrong. For like the grass, they soon fade away. Like spring flowers, they soon wither. Commit everything you do to the Lord. Trust him, and he will help us. Listen to the next verse. He will make our innocence radiate like the dawn, and the justice of our cause will shine like the noonday. And you want to talk about upside down countercultural living. Verse 7 goes on, be still in the presence of the Lord and wait patiently for him to act. Don't worry about evil people who prosper. Don't fret about their wicked schemes. Stop being angry. Don't lose your temper. It only leads to harm. Don't drop the gloves. I just put that in there. The wicked plot against the ungodly. They snarl at them in defiance, but the Lord just laughs. Why does the Lord laugh? For he sees our day of judgment. It is coming. Jesus' response to Pilate is a beautiful picture of how to confront personal injustice. Remember last week, We went through how Jesus was arrested in the garden. It was Peter that whipped out his sword and cut off the ear of the high priest's servant. I quite often wonder if Peter had that image going through his mind when a few years later he wrote these words. He didn't retaliate when he was insulted, nor threaten revenge when he suffered. Instead, he left his case in the hands of God, who always judges fairly. He left his case in the hands of God, who always judges fairly. Have we? When choosing silence, Jesus gives injustice a face. He shames the powers of the world, all the while knowing and believing that at a certain point in time, the perfect time, God, his Father, our Father, the only righteous judge, would set things right. Do you believe that to be true, stranger? The third president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, rightly said, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that his justice cannot sleep forever." Mary Todd Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's wife, said, "Clouds and darkness surround us, and yet heaven is just, and the day of triumph will surely come when justice and truth will be vindicated." On that horrible and yet glorious day of accounting, of recompense, of vindication, Jesus will be recognized for who he was and is. Philippians chapter 2 says that on that day, every knee will bow of those in heaven and of those on earth and of those under the earth, and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. So when it came to the injustice against others, Jesus lived in an upside-down manner, revealing injustice against others for the crime that it is, and offering a gospel alternative that breathes life and love into the lives of the vulnerable. When it came to injustice against himself, he left his case in the hands of God, knowing and believing that at a certain point in time, God, his Father, our Father, the only righteous judge, is going to set things right. Ecclesiastes 3:17 says, "In due season, God will judge everyone, both the good and the bad, for all of their deeds." What a day that will be. I remember singing as a young lad, "There is coming a day when no heartaches shall come. No more clouds in the sky, no more tears to dim the eye. All is peace forevermore on that happy golden shore. There'll be no sorrow there, no more funerals, no more wakes, no more divorce court. No more burdens to bear, no more sickness, no more pain, no more parting over there, and forever I will be with the one who died for me." What a day. What a glorious day. I know I'm getting old because I've started using glorious in everyday conversation. People will say, "How's your day going?" "It's glorious." And they look at me like, "Are you 300? What a glorious day. Yes, thank you, thank you. No more burdens, no more sickness, no more pain, no more parting, no more sin, no more grief." I love when God orchestrates. I was contacted middle of the week to ask if if we could do something this morning. And I just had to smile and laugh out loud when I was asked, because of the way it just complements this morning. So there's not some twisted agenda about what we're going to do here at the end. This morning we would like to present to you as a church body a really cool opportunity by which we can practically confront the injustice of poverty. In just a few weeks' time, Shayna, who a lot of you know and some of you don't, Shayna and Garth and Andrea Sliz are going to be traveling to Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. And with that trip, we as a church body are being offered a really practical way that we can confront injustice of poverty. And so we're going to watch a brief video of